Good morning, Shabbat Shalom, and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning scripture study coming to you live from St. Francisville. Thank you so much for joining us. Last week, we covered in a little bit of a shift in our current study, we covered a class that I titled The Pentateuch, Who, When, and Whence. Who, When, and Whence. And in that study, I announced that we'll be taking more of a close look, a very close look, at the text of the five books. We're looking particularly for evidence of what did Moses write. And in the process of this study, we're clearly going to see things that I'll point out as we work our way through these texts that also indicate what Moses did not write. And so some of you might think, well, how can you be so sure? I want to encourage you to pay close attention and to stay with me on this because it's not magic. It's not very difficult. It's actually fairly straightforward when we stay close to the text. When we look at the text, we're looking for, is there anything that evinces another hand? Is there anything that gives itself away as we read through these time-honored texts that we love and cherish so much? And I like to start with this because we are getting into some things which might be a bit challenging, but I want to reassure you on this that this is not a negative enterprise. We're not doing this to take away from the Hebrew Scriptures. What we're doing is we're trying to zero in, focus in, and try to identify authorship, things of that nature. We're also, as we work through these texts, we're looking for evidence that is around the idea of dating. So the timing of a text. Can we tell with any degree of certainty when we look at a particular text, Can we get from the text evidence that suggests when the text was written? And again, we're also looking for the other side of that coin. When was a text not written? So there are some things that we'll read and we'll say, you know, I don't know exactly when that was written. There's no date. But I also can tell that it clearly was not written, i.e., particularly at the time of Moses. So we're looking for evidence that suggests when a text was written and when it was not written, and particularly if something is appearing in the text that gives itself away, just like we see some things that we say, you know, Moses didn't write that. I don't know who wrote it, but Moses didn't write it. Or someone at Moses' time did not write that. And those things exist within the text. So one of the things that I want to make clear is that biblically speaking, if we're talking, and we are dealing with biblical matters, so biblically speaking, we get to what is presented as the time of Moses, really once we get to Exodus chapter 2. So technically, Exodus chapter 2 through Deuteronomy chapter 34, this material is presented as reflecting the time of Moses. I carefully worded that. It is presented as written to detail the events of the time of Moses. Exodus chapter 2 is the birth of Moses. Deuteronomy chapter 34 chronicles, among other things, the death of Moses. So in that window, in that large section of Pentateuchal material, we're dealing with the time of Moses. Now, we've also shown, I've shown over the past several weeks, months, and even as far back as April of 2019, when I first introduced this type of study to United Israel's audience, one of the things that we've discovered is that there is some material within the Pentateuch which clearly falls outside of the time of Moses and rules itself out as something that could possibly have been written by Moses. And you know these things. We've covered them extensively, but just to highlight, third-person material, it doesn't seem that a person writing would use the third person consistently. And what we find particularly in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, and even Deuteronomy, a good majority of Deuteronomy, is written in the third person. And the Lord spoke unto Moses. It's more natural, if Moses is the author, that he would say, "And the Lord spoke unto me." Now, we do get some of that material, as you know from our previous studies. We get some of that in Deuteronomy. Now, we also see, as we work through the text of the five books, we also see what I've introduced as anachronism. It's a word that means basically, coming from the Greek, backwards time. It's language which is non-contemporary, which occurs within the text of the Pentateuch. So it will be talking as if it's presented in the time of Moses, and then there's something in the text that says, "I'm not from that time." It gives itself away. So anachronism, we've seen that. We also have seen editorial updating, where a name, for instance, a place name, is inserted into the text, and that is meant by the scribe or the author or the editor, the redactor, to give us a more modern name at the time of his writing. So this place was called such and such, but it was known as Luz at the first. So we get those kind of editorial insertions, and we have to look for those things. Geography becomes our friend. Things that people often read over, maybe it's a bit boring, maybe it's a bit difficult to work through. We look at these kind of things, and a lot of times we read over it and don't pay close attention. But I want you to know that geography becomes our friend. We have to look carefully at places, people, and all of these different clues that the text give us in order to arrive at an understanding of what the text actually means and what it's actually saying. Now, we also have seen that in some cases within the five books, we have multiple accounts that provide varying details. For instance, last week I talked a little bit about the wilderness itinerary. And if you read the wilderness itinerary, particularly spotted throughout Exodus and then some in the book of Numbers, particularly Numbers chapter 33, and you look at that horizontally, as I would call it, you would take the story that's given, say, for instance, in Numbers 33, that order of travel, and you compare it with what we find in Deuteronomy 1 through 3, and you see some what we could call discrepancies or variations. And so we're left with the puzzle of which one more accurately reflects what actually took place. Now, again, we're pointing out difficulties, we're pointing out challenges within the text, but our motives are pure. We're looking to discern what is the earliest strata of the text. What takes us back the closest to the events that are described within these texts? Now, clearly, these that I've just mentioned, as well as other points that we've covered, indicate that contra the traditional view that Moses wrote the five books, what we realize because of these is that the Torah, as it's called, the five books, the Pentateuch, the Chumash, that this body of sacred history, sacred literature, sacred law, in its present form, that is how you have it today in your Bible, was not written by the hand of Moses or during his time. But that's not to be troubling, because a lot of these later editions, editorial insertions and so forth, are meant to bring the text up to date. It does not take away from, in many cases, the veracity of the text. So don't get me wrong, that's not what I'm doing. But I want to peel those away, and what will be left then should bring us closer to the words of Moses, the time of Moses. Now, I believe that this can be accomplished. I believe that at the core of the five books, we can trace a certain portion of the text, the laws, the stories, and so forth, back to the actual events. I believe that. Some people don't. More liberal, what we would call minimalist scholars, don't even believe in Moses. They don't believe he ever existed, and that they think that this is a futile exercise. But I believe that there is a core message, a core document, if you will, that's embedded within, that's been interpolated and expanded over time. I think we can peel some of that ladder away and get back to the original and trace back what it said at the time of the Moses. Now, what that tells us is that our present work has been and has undergone various editing. It's been added to, it's been updated to reflect later understanding and so forth. And it also reflects the work of others. Now, who are those others? People speculate. Some people speculate this group of scribes or that group of scribes. But quite honestly, most of that is conjecture. It's based on little evidence. It's short on evidence and long on speculation. So what we're actually looking for is, what can we determine? Remember, I say this over and over, with any degree of certainty, what's authentic, what's the most ancient, and so forth. Now, in other words, one of the things that I want to underscore as I get into today's class is that despite or in spite of these editorial updates and anachronism and so forth that appears in the text, I believe that we can have a true story even with the non-contemporary additions, if that makes sense. Today, I want to start a closer look at the book of Genesis. Now, I love Genesis. I think most of us love the stories in Genesis. It brings to us the most profound things, these teachings, these stories that go back, according to the ancient Hebrew tradition, from the creation of the cosmos through the pre-patriarchal times, where we encounter all the way from Adam through Noah. We read the stories of this flood, the deluge. We read these stories. We've all grown up with these stories, and they've influenced us and inspired us over time. Then we get into the stories of the patriarchs of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the matriarchs, and how a nation comes to be that God chooses to establish his plan and his way upon the earth. We bring this story from the creation of the cosmos, and it ultimately ends at the death of Jacob and Joseph. This book of Genesis, not only is it beautiful and it contains all these wonderful stories that we love, but it is foundational. It sets the stage, if you will, for everything that follows in the Bible, for the Jewish faith, for the Christian faith, and it's influenced also the Islamic faith. So if we think about the importance of these fundamental, bedrock, foundational stories, we've got to go back to Genesis. We're told over and over that this is the beginning. In fact, the book of Genesis is the book of beginning. The term in Hebrew, Genesis, is tied to the word genesia, the beginning. In the Hebrew, it's bereshi, at the first or at the start. Takes us all the way back. The book of beginnings, the beginnings not only of the earth and the cosmos, but of God's people and God's plan. But Genesis presents some special cases for us in our present study. And what do I mean by that? Genesis makes no claim to narrate events from the time of Moses. Would you agree? Genesis, even the very last events, the death of Jacob and Joseph, which are depicted or written about at the end of Genesis, occur some roughly 400 years before we meet Moses. So even many of these stories, just to make this point clear, and I know you know this, many of these stories would have been ancient by the time of Moses. So if you think about it, the book of Genesis, we're not going to be able to look and say, is this story from the time of Moses? You can clearly say no. I mean, it's not, and it doesn't claim to be. So what are we looking for in the book of Genesis to go along with our present quest? In Genesis, we're forced to ask different questions of the text. We are led, if you will, to seek different answers and to recognize different clues. We're not looking quite for the same thing when we look at the book of Genesis as we are, particularly when we read from Exodus 2 through Deuteronomy 34:12. We're looking for different clues than what the rest of the Pentateuch's material purportedly describes as being representative of events from the time of Moses. But here are a couple of the questions that I want to put on the table today as we open up the book of Genesis. We want to ask, in the form that we have it, the present book of Genesis, was it written by a single author? Okay? Because, as you know, tradition says that Moses wrote the five books. Now, this is clearly the case whether one is Jewish or Christian or Muslim. The belief, the fundamentalist belief, is that Genesis is the work of Moses. And this has been under scrutiny for hundreds and hundreds of years because of some of the evidences that are there within the text of Genesis. But is it, this is a question, is it the work of a single author, be it Moses or another? Or can we detect multiple hands within the book of Genesis? Now, I know some people even commented on the Facebook post that I posted and said, yes, you can detect. The trick is not to say whether that's true or not. The trick is, where is it? What are those passages? And that's what we have to look at. We have to look and see, because remember, Genesis is not saying it happened during the days of Moses, but can we tell if the one writing it, or as the case might be, the ones writing it, if it reflects more than one hand, can we discern the evidence of later in the contemporary reports? Now, in the form that we have it, does it reflect an author, a viewpoint, a perspective from another time? There are. I'm going to go ahead and give you a few examples of non-contemporary language. So what I mean by this is a story within Genesis, which is clearly from a time before the time of Moses. If a person in the time of Moses wrote it, that would be reflected in the text. But if we find text within Genesis that suggests that someone beyond or later than the time of Moses had a hand in it, we need to know that. That's one of the things we're looking for today. So without further ado, we're going to get into the first example that I want to give. And I'm not giving all. I just want to give a few examples of each of the points that I'm bringing up in today's class. So look with me this morning, Genesis chapter 12. Genesis chapter 12. And by the way, those of you who know your Bible, which I assume is everyone in this audience, know that Genesis 12 is really the call of Avram. So it's the beginning, if you will, of the people of God, that God chose Avram. Remember, Avram lives in Ur of the Chaldees. He's called from there to go to a place that God will show him. I want you to look with me at Genesis chapter 12, and let's look at verse 6. Genesis 12, 6 says, Avram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. And then Jehovah appeared to Avram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built there an altar to Jehovah who had appeared to him. Now, this particular passage gives us a clue that it was written at a later time. Now, we read over these quite often, and it goes unnoticed. But here's what it says. In the Hebrew, a two-letter word appears, Az. Aleph, Zion. And it's translated typically, then. Then. The author who writes this particular text says something very true. He says that at this time, the Canaanites were in the land. Now, that statement is true in the time of Avram. And get this, it's also true at the time of Moses. So what this tells us then is that the time of Avram, the setting of the story, and the time of Moses, that the Canaanites were then in the land. But what this text tells us, if you pay attention, is that whoever is writing this is most naturally, the way it reads, most naturally writing at a time when the Canaanites were not in the land. You see? Of course, the Canaanites were in the land when Avram in Genesis chapter 12, and even in the time of Moses. The Canaanites would be in the land for centuries after the time of Moses. So whoever is writing this is saying, speaking from a time when the Canaanites were not in the land, and he's saying, that was then, Oz, and this is now. When this happened, it's like what we say when I tell stories to my kids. I remember my grandmother would read us stories, and she would say, once upon a time. That's what this text is saying. Well, once upon a time, the Canaanites were in the land. And the reader, the contemporary reader at the time when this first gets published on Amazon back in the day, would say, wow, they had Canaanites in the land? Yes, yes. That's right. Once upon a time, there was. Now, whenever now is. So that was then, Canaanites were in the land, and this is now, whenever now is. Now, what all we know, we don't have a date. All we know is that this text is written at a time when the Canaanites are no longer in the land. Now, look down with me at Genesis chapter 13. And verse 7, I want to give you another example just right next to it. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Avram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. At that time, the Canaanites and the Perizzites were dwelling in the land. So again, we have a non-contemporary point being made. Once upon a time, the Canaanites and the Perizzites were in the land. Do you see that? So it's clearly written at a time when that's no longer applicable. It's no longer the case. Whoever the author is, whenever he's writing this, is at a time when the Canaanites and the Perizzites are no longer in the land. Now, go with me to Genesis chapter 36. Genesis chapter 36. We're just going to go through a few of these examples, not all. There are extensive evidences, but I've just picked out a few. Now, by the way, Genesis chapter 36 is the Esau's descendants. So it's primarily dealing with the story of Esau's family. And by the way, it's somewhat interruptive. If you pulled Genesis 36 out and you just read 35 and 37, the narrative would flow. See? It's like it's placed in here, not that it's not important, not that it's not relevant, but it seems a bit out of place. Now, what I want you to do is go with me to Genesis 36 and verse 31. And it says, "These are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the Israelites." And then it gives a full list of kings that goes for many, many generations. Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom, the name of his city being Dinhabah. Bela died Joab, and it goes on and on and on. But what this is really telling us is that this list brings us up to a time when Israel had kings. Do you see that? These are the kings that reigned in Edom before Israel had any kings. In other words, this list of Edomite kings will bring you to the time when Israel, right before Israel had a king. Now, who is the king that Israel first had, officially on the books? Shaul, Saul. So it's saying Saul was the first king. This list of Edomite kings will bring you up to Saul's time. So that indicates to me that the time of this particular passage would be at earliest roughly the time of the beginning of the monarchy. Now, Saul, and look, people debate over the exact timing. People can debate over, the chronology, and I've studied the list of the kings. Many of you have as well, and you're looking at all this stuff. Many of you, like me, have handy little charts that show this. Some of you have spent weeks working on this, like I have, I'm sure, where you're looking at concurrent reigns, and this king reigned for this many years, and looking at 1 Kings versus Chronicles, and how do we map it all together? I know, you've done it, I've done it. But roughly, this is a rough. Saul reigned in 1050 BCE. Now again, dating. People debate the dating. But let's say, for the sake of argument, that the Exodus occurs roughly 1450 BCE. All right? So that's the time of Moses, give or take. Put 120-year moving window on that 1450 date, you see, to capture the time of Moses. But 1450 BCE to 1050 BCE is 400 years. So a possible time of writing of this particular part is very interesting, is 400 years after the time of Moses when this would be written. So there are examples that indicate to us that at least an editorial phase takes place during a time when the Israelites are settled in the land and the Canaanites are no longer a problem and the Perizzites are no longer a problem and there are kings within Israel. That puts you farther than what many people expect, right? Doesn't mean it's not true. I want you to get that. I want you to understand that whoever adds this or even writes this is not necessarily writing something that I think is false. I do believe that the Canaanites were in the land when Avram when Genesis chapter 12. I do believe that the Canaanites and the Perizzites were in the land when the herdsmen of Lot and Avram were fighting over wells. But I know that they weren't out of the land, so that indicates a later date for composition. Now, we also get updated place names that we find in the text. We get a later name for a place that was not known at the time when these contemporary events took place. So go with me to Genesis 13. Genesis 13. And I want to read verse 18. Genesis 13, 18. So Avram moved his tent and came and settled by the oaks of Mamre, which are at Hebron, and there he built an altar to Jehovah. Seems pretty clear cut. What is the evidence that I'm going to bring forward that suggests that this was not written during the time of Moses? Look with me to Joshua 14. Joshua 14. In Joshua 14, verse 15, it says the following. Let's look at verse 14, Joshua 14, 14 and 15. Therefore, Hebron became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, to this day. That's an interesting class in and of itself, because he wholly followed Jehovah, the God of Israel. Now, the name of Hebron formerly was Kiriat Arba. Arba was the greatest man among the Anakim, and the land had rest from war. The name of Hebron is a later name. The original name, the time when Avram would have moved his tent there, it was not called Hebron. It was called Kiriat Arba. Look down at chapter 15 of verse 13, chapter 15, verse 13 of Joshua. According to the commandment of Jehovah to Joshua, he gave to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, a portion among the people of Judah, Kiriat Arba, that is Hebron. Arba was the father of Anak. Now, what begins to happen is that people scribes would update the text in earlier documents, in earlier scrolls. And we don't know who these scribes are. People can speculate, but we don't know who they were. All right? But what we know is they begin to update. Go back and look at Genesis 23. Genesis 23, this is an example of a scribal update. Verse 2, and Sarah died at Kiriat Arba, parentheses, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. So this is my conjecture here, is that the original text said, and Sarah died at Kiriat Arba in the land of Canaan. A later scribe says, hey, that's Hebron. Because somebody would read it, perhaps, and say, where'd she die? Kiriat Arba. What is Kiriat Arba? You know, Hebron. Ah, Hebron. Why didn't you say Hebron, Mordecai? You should have just said Hebron. You said Kiriat Arba. I don't know. But it's updated. Look at verse 19, chapter 23, Genesis 23, 19. After this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah, east of Mamre, parentheses, that's Hebron, in the land of Canaan. Look at chapter 35, verse 27, Genesis 35, 27. What's happening is a later pen, non-contemporary to the original text, is going in updating 35, verse 27. And Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre, or Kiriat Arba, parentheses, that is, Hebron, close parentheses, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. Now, this didn't just happen in the English Bible. This happens in the Hebrew text, right? So it's not that this is updated only once King James went to press. This is old. It doesn't, again, it doesn't mean that Hebron is not Kiriat Arba. It actually means the opposite. Hebron is Kiriat Arba. Kiriat Arba is an older name. Hebron is the updated name, and it's reflected in the text. Same thing happens. Look at Genesis 14. Genesis 14, and I just want to pick up verse 14. When Avram heard that his kinsman had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Well, how many of you have been to Israel? Now, that's a long trip up to Dan. It's even a pretty long trip in a bus. But he goes to Dan. Says he went to Dan. I believe he went to Dan. But look with me at Judges chapter 18. Judges chapter 18, and I want you to pick up verse 29. Now, by the way, before this, the people of Dan are looking for a place to call their home in this text. And verse 29 says, they found this place, right? And it says, and they named the city Dan after the name of Dan, their ancestor, who was born to Israel. But the name of the city was Laish at the first. Another text says Lashem, but Laish at first. And the people of Dan set up the carved image for themselves, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, son of Moses, some translations twist that a little bit and say Manasseh so that you won't have a priestly descendant of Moses, which we already covered that, remember. And his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the time of the captivity of the land. So they set up Micah's carved image that he made as long as the house of God was at Shiloh. Now this one is jam-packed with you need to pay attention to's. Okay? So first of all, the thing that we learn is that the place that the Danites find at this time, in the time of the judges, they name it Dan then. But it wasn't called Dan back in the days of Avram or Abraham. It was called Laish. But it's been updated in Genesis 14:14 because the place wasn't called Dan then. It's only called Dan at this point. And by the way, this text is written at a much later period. How do we know? It's written at a later period than the Judges because it says that the children of Moses were priests until the day of the captivity of the land. So this text was written at the earliest after the captivity, right? So it's much later. And it says that as long as the tabernacle stood at Shiloh, we can figure out the date there. It stood at Shiloh for 369 years. So this naming of Dan and the priesthood of the sons of Moses, this is being written about at a time much, much later. But my point about Dan is that in Genesis 14 is clearly a later interpolation or an adjustment to the text to bring it up to speed. Now, by the way, we're not doing Deuteronomy today. We're doing Genesis. But I do want you to look at Deuteronomy 34. Deuteronomy 34 says this, then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, which is opposite Jericho, And Jehovah showed him all the land, Gilead, as far as Dan. Dan wasn't the name of the place until much later. So this, too, is written at a later period. But we already knew that. It's no big deal, because Deuteronomy 34 also describes the death and burial of Moses. It also says that there has not arisen a prophet like Moses in Israel, which indicates that it's reflecting many, many years back. So, but we do see that geography becomes very important. When we read these place names, we ought to wonder, especially if the text tells us, parentheses, now there's no parentheses in the Hebrew, but there is a way to indicate that something is parenthetical. You know, a lot of times it will say, that is Hebron. Kiryat Arba, Sarah does it, Kiryat Arba, that is Hebron, parenthetical. Now, but what we see over and over is an updating of some of these texts. One other text just for your consideration, go to Genesis chapter 40. Genesis chapter 40 and verse 15. Now, this is a story, Joseph is telling the story about how he ended up in Egypt. In verse 15, he says, "For I was indeed stolen out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also I have done nothing that they should put me into the pit." At the time of Joseph, what was the land of the Hebrews? Was there technically a land of the Hebrews? You could say, well, yeah, you know, Abraham is there. He's sojourning, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. But is that the land of the Hebrews, or does that reflect something later when the land of Canaan is officially the land of the Hebrews? I leave that one to your discretion. But I find it to be somewhat of an indicator that perhaps this too points to a later hand. Now, these examples only indicate that the narrative that we've covered off, you know, through these particular passages has been updated at a later period. In other words, as far as what I've covered so far, nothing suggests that the text as a whole is ultimately late. But at least we see signs of updates and revisions. But perhaps it still leaves us room to consider that there is a singular author who composed an original document which was only updated here and there, right? So that could be. That's an option that's on the table for this minute. The question becomes, how is it that the composition of Genesis is accomplished? Is it by a singular author or a scribe? Does the evidence from the text suggest that this person is better described as a compiler, an assembler, a collector, or is author the right way to put it? In other words, does this person who gives us Genesis in the form that we have it, or these persons, if it's more than one, are they better described as assemblers of information? Can we detect the presence of sources of various historical documents that have been woven together sometimes better than at other times? In other words, sometimes it's a little rough around the edges. Sometimes we have various accounts of the same thing, and they're put together, and you can really see the rough edges. It's not a clean cut and paste. And I want to give you some examples of those. Let's go back to the example I used, Esau. I want to talk about the women of Esau now, the wives. Stuff you probably, I don't know, some of you might know. If I said, close your Bibles and get out a pen and piece of paper, how many wives did Esau have, and what are their names, and who are their father-in-laws? you know, give me that, and just see how well you do. I wouldn't have done well. I studied this week, and I want to cover this with you today. Go with me, please, to the book of Genesis, chapter 26. I want to show you the presence of different sources that were compiled to form our beautiful, wonderful Genesis, all right? So Genesis 26, I want to go to verse 34, Genesis 26, 34. When Esau was 40 years old, he took Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, to be his wife, and Basmat, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and they made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah. All right, so he's got two women, Judith, daughter of Beeri the Hittite. Now, you need to make a list. I want you to have three columns. Column, left-hand column, Genesis 26, 34 through 35. And you write, number one wife is named Judith, daughter of Beeri the Hittite. Number two, you can do this later, by the way. Number two is Basmat, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. Now, go with me to 28 and verse 9. 28 and verse 9. Esau went to Ishmael and took as his wife, besides the wives that he had, Mahalat, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebaioth. Nebaioth. All right, so now we've got a third wife. Mahalat, you put column number two, Genesis 28:9. Mahalat, the daughter of Ishmael, the son of Abraham, sister of Nebaioth. Now go to chapter 36. I'm not going to dwell on this long. Just I want you to have it so you can study it on your own. All right, 36, Genesis 36:2. Esau took his wives from the Canaanites, Ada, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, Aholibamah, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon the Hivite, and Basmat, Ishmael's daughter, the sister of Nebaioth. All right, so we've got some similarity in names. We have some things that look a little bit alike, but they also got some trouble here. One might read over this and miss the complexities and the great difficulty for reconciling these. Now, I know that, you know, we have various genealogical tables trying to trace this out, and people work on this problem too, but I want them to work on this one. This is the one I want them to solve, because Genesis 26, we have two daughters. Esau has two women who are daughters of Hittite men. I'm not going to put names on them yet. Two daughters of Hittite men, and the daddies are Beeri and Elon. Now, Genesis 26, the daughter of Elon is Basmat. Now, that name occurs in two different places. Genesis 36, the daughter of Elon that's called Basmat in chapter 26 is now called Ada. Now, you could say, well, you know, some people called her Basmat, some people called her Ada. That was her nickname. I'm sorry. That's not the answer here. Okay. Genesis 26, and this is going to look a lot nicer on your chart. You're going to do this. This is homework for you. Basmat in Genesis 26 is the daughter of Elon the Hittite. It's not Ada. In 36, Basmat is a wife of Esau, but she's the daughter of Ishmael and the sister of Nebaioth. Now, that's a lot of detail. This woman, Genesis 36, says, excuse me, what's your name? My name is Basmat. Basmat, who's your daddy? And she could tell the daddy, who's your sister? And she'd say, well, my sister is Nebaioth. Well, and whose daughter are you? Ishmael. And your name is Basmat, yes. But in 28:9, you go to the same girl and you say, are you the daughter of Ishmael? I am. And are you the sister of Nebaioth? I am. And what's your name? Mahalot. It's different. Do they also know you as Basmat? No. So here's what we know. What's clear and consistent is that Esau has three women, two Canaanite and an Ishmaelite. This is not as simply solved as the apologists want to do by saying this person is known by other names, even though they might give examples of other cases of that, because the confusion comes in when you look at the other details, whose daughter, whose sister, make the chart. I want you to see this, because one of these daughters, here's what we know, two Canaanite women and an Ishmaelite woman. One was named Basmat. We know that. It's consistent. And we also know that one of his father-in-laws was Elon the Hittite. But the details get confused. What the author, the compiler, the arranger of Genesis, and you could put a plural on that if it's more than one, is bringing to the document a couple of divergent records. They don't agree. And you might say, well, who cares? Well, most people don't care because not many people have really looked at the genealogy of Esau. But I use this as an example to show you that we have sources being used. Apparently, the compiler had more than one of these sources, and thankfully, I'm thankful that we preserved these three pericopes, or these three snippets, if you will. Now, there are sources used in Genesis. In other places in Genesis, we have multiple versions of the same story, if you will, but like the list of Esau's wives, they sometimes have differences and they occur together, and we read over them and do not note the differences. The book of Genesis is wonderful. It's beautiful, poetic, tells us all these stories. It begins with the creation. We have two accounts of creation in Genesis, and they're side by side. They're very close to one another. If we read closely, we're going to notice something. Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 through chapter 2, verse 3 is account number 1, and it tells a story. Day 1, the creation of light. Day 2, an expanse is made. Day 3, the land appears. The gathering of waters takes place and plants and vegetation appear. Day 4, lights appear in the heavens. Day 5, living creatures of water and air, but not land. Day 6, living land animals and mankind, both male and female, are created. So we have an order. Plants, animals, man and woman. This is Genesis 1. If you just turn the page, and if you just read carefully, Genesis chapter 2 is from another source. It also tells the story of the creation. Now, for years, like other people, like other teachers, I said, oh, this is different, but that's okay. But one is a top-down view and the other is a bottom-up view. It's like chapter 2 just zooms in, but that's not what we find. Genesis chapter 2, beginning in verse 4 through chapter 3, is about the generations of the heavens and the earth. There's no bush, there's no small plant. There's no rain and there's no man. And then in chapter 2, verse 7, man is created. Man is created. There's not a woman. And then in 2, verse 19, the beasts are formed, land and air. And man names the beasts. There's no woman. And then in chapter 2, verse 20, this Adam is put to sleep in a tardemah, deep sleep, a trance-like state, and a An atzelah, translated a rib, is pulled out, a chamber, a cell is pulled out of the male slash female. He's both male and female. And the woman is built. And so we have an order. Man, plants, animal, woman. Genesis 1 is plants, animal, man, woman. The order of the creation is different. These are from two different sources. Now pay attention, because source number one in Genesis 1, consistently, without exception, uses Elohim. That's right. Uses Elohim only from Genesis 1:1 through 2:3. And by the way, that's one section without a break. In the ancient Hebrew scroll, or in modern Hebrew Bibles even now, you'll find a white space after chapter 2, verse 3, meaning this chunk is one story. And then picking up at chapter 2, verse 4, it begins second story of the creation. I am so thankful that whoever put this together gave us both of these ancient stories. The first one talks about Elohim as the deity. The second one introduces us to a name that we don't know. It's masked in English because it just says Lord, or Lord God, I should say. But in this text, in this story of creation, the name Jehovah or Yehovah is mentioned. I'm going to leave that right there for you. Now let's talk about the flood. Go with me to Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 9. Very common, well known. Everybody knows the story of the flood, do you not? Chapter 6, verse 9. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with Elohim, God. And Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, Elohim. And the earth was filled with violence. And Elohim saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt. For all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And Elohim said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. This is how you are to make it. The length of the ark, 300 cubits. Its breadth, 50. Its height, 30 cubits. Make a roof for the ark and finish it to a cubit above and set a door of the ark in its side. Make it with lower, second, third decks. For behold, I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh, in which is the breath of life under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you. And you shall come into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female, of the birds according to their kind, of the animals according to their kind, of every creeping thing of the ground according to its kind. Two of every sort shall come into you to keep them alive. Also take with you every sort of food that is eaten, and store it up. It shall serve as food for you for them. Noah did this. He did all that Elohim commanded him. Okay, a couple of things. Consistently in this story, the deity is called Elohim, without exception. There's not mention of the divine name, the tetragrammaton, the name Jehovah, Yehovah. This particular story of the flood is an ancient story of the flood in which God is called Elohim, not Jehovah. And then there's a break. Now get ready. Oh, by the way, and in this story, two of every kind of animal. It's very clear. Every kind of animal, two by two by two by two. That's the kind you see in the Sunday school books, and that's right, according to this story. Two by two. That's it. Now, chapter 7, verse 1. Then, I want you to pay attention now. Then Jehovah said to Noah, go into the ark, you and all your household, for I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. Sounds a lot like Genesis 6:8. Take with you seven pairs of all clean animals, the male and his mate, a pair of the animals that are not clean, the male and his mate, seven pairs of the birds of the heavens also, male and female, to keep their offspring alive on the face of the earth, on the face of all the earth. For in 7 days I will send rain on the earth, 40 days, 40 nights, and every living thing that I have made I will blot out from the face of the ground. And Noah did all that Jehovah had commanded him. Different story, different details, different name of God, different details, different amount of animals. Now, we read, they're right together. So we read them and we go, okay, God said bring two of two, this and that, and he just referred to himself as Elohim. But then in the next, he gives him a little more. It's Jehovah this time, being very specific. Now he tells him to bring clean and clean. Who said anything about clean? What does that mean? What do we know about clean and unclean? Now, most people use this to say clean and unclean goes all the way back. God told the Torah to Adam. Adam told it to Seth. Seth told it all the way down. And then ultimately it made it into Leviticus, Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14. But it's always been known. That's questionable. We have two accounts here. They're right together. The compiler, the arranger, the final redactor, the editor, the author, however you want to put it at this present. We're going to go deeper later. But you just, however you feel comfortable with this, what we have is that person put these two ancient stories side by side. Now, if you begin with the beginning of the Noah epic and you read all the way through the end, you're going to see back and forth. Here's one part of the story that talks about it and uses this name. Here's very interesting. What about the name change of Jacob to Israel? Go with me to Genesis 32. Genesis 32. And the text runs from verse 22. Genesis 32. The same night, verse 22, he arose and took his two wives, two female servants, his 11 children, crossed the ford of the Yavok, or the Jabbok, as we say in English. He took them and sent them across the stream, everything else that he had. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, Jacob's hip socket, was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the day is broken." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." He said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with Elohim and with men and have prevailed." And Jacob asked him, "Please tell me your name." He said, "Why do you ask after my name?" And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, "For I have seen Elohim face to face, yet my life has been delivered." The sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip and so forth. You know the story. Now, this particular story describes the naming, changing of the name from Jacob to Israel. Listen, no longer shall your name be called Jacob, but Israel will be your name. Now look down the next verse, chapter 33, verse 1. And Jacob lifted up his eyes. And it happens over and over and over and over. Your name is, what's your name? Jacob. It's not going to be Jacob anymore. It's going to be Israel. And then Jacob got up and left. Interesting. Now look at chapter 35. We have another story of the naming of Israel. Chapter 35, verse 10. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob." This is several chapters later. And by the way, and Elohim said, "Your name is Jacob. No longer shall your name be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." So he called his name Israel. And God said to him, "I am El Shaddai. Be fruitful and multiply. Nation and company of nations shall come forth from you. and kings shall come from your own body. The land that I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I give to you, and I will give the land to your offspring after you. Then God went up from him in the place where he had spoken with him, and Jacob set up a pillar. I thought his name was Israel now. In the place where he had spoken with him, a pillar of stone, he poured out a drink offering on it and poured oil on it. So Jacob called the name of the place where God, Elohim, had spoken with him, Bethel. Now, if you look down at verse 22, Israel lived in that land. So you get from this point on, you start seeing sometimes he's called Jacob, sometimes he's called Israel. Why does the name change have no effect, it seems, in some of these texts? Genesis reflects evidence of multiple stories of the same event, clearly different versions of those events, using different names for the deity, clearly indicating evidence of being written at different periods, and that the sources were employed in the composition of the book as we now have it. Now, if you back up and you say, so God changed the name of Jacob to Israel, that's the gist of both of these stories. But they're different stories. What we want to do is examine these different stories, and why do we have, in many cases, sometimes more, but in many cases, some of the main stories that you know and love, there are two accounts of it, and they're different. Why two? There's an answer to that. It's in the Bible. We're going to find that. We're going to get to that point. You're going to see that with your own eyes, and it's going to be a eureka moment. What I'm going to really focus on, I want us to take a closer look at the names for the deity. How is it that it occurs, the name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the Tetragrammaton, Jehovah, Yehovah, how is it that that name appears as early as Genesis 2:4, and all the way, by the way, in Genesis alone, the name occurs 165 times, if the stats on accordance are right. Usually I go ahead and count them, but I didn't count them last night. 165 times, as early as Genesis 2:4. But you know that according to Exodus 6, that name was not known until it was given to Moses. We need to dig into this. We need to study about this difference here. And we're going to do that next Saturday. Join me next Saturday morning, 10:30 a.m. Central Time. God willing, Jehovah willing, and we're going to look at the distinction of the authors of the Bible and the use of various names for the deity. Shabbat Shalom, Shavua Tov.